Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, in the era of big mergers and acquisitions throughout the healthcare industry, it appears another mega merger is in the works. A few months after CVS announced it was buying the insurance giant Aetna, now retail giant Walmart is moving towards a merger with the insurance carrier Humana. It's another industry pairing that's generating a lot of buzz.
Strange couples and odd bedfellows, but it does seem to signal an interesting trend of taking the healthcare industry into the marketplaces where people interact daily. The CVS Aetna deal, if we think about that one, was based on the premise that you can do more to impact health when the consumer has a direct access to services right in their own neighborhood or work setting. And that could signal a shift in how population health might be supported by frequent interfaces at places like the local pharmacy, of which there seems to be one on every corner in America
really
now.
It does, Margaret. And you're absolutely right. It does signal a significant shift in the marketplace. These mergers still have to be approved, and it may take quite a while before we see any real shift in the healthcare marketplace. Meanwhile, a lot of anticipation from the recently announced partnership between Amazon, Berkshire Hathaway, and JP Morgan Chase, who think they can use their collective economic might to shift the needle on healthcare costs. Lots of external forces are at play in the healthcare industry right now, and it'd be interesting to see where all of these go.
But really, what all these entities claim that they are seeking to do is to find ways to make healthcare more consumer-focused and easier to access. And as we know, what keeps health costs down over time is the focus on all of the upstream causes of poor health, like poverty, insecure housing, poor nutrition, poorly controlled chronic illnesses. And that's something that our guest today has focused professional efforts on for decades.
Kelly Bruno is president and CEO of the National Health Foundation. The Southern California-based organization is dedicated to launching innovative programs addressing the barriers to health that affect certain communities and special populations who often find themselves outside the best that the healthcare system has to offer.
Well, Kelly has launched some very effective programs that seem to be having a positive impact. And I think, Mark, it's worth noting that these programs are very scalable and replicable across the country. So we're really looking forward to that conversation.
Lori Robertson also checks in. She's the managing editor of factcheck.org. She looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com or find us on iTunes as well.
And if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, because we love to hear from you. We'll get to our interview with Kelly Bruno of the National Health Foundation in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. He said, a war of words between ousted VA Secretary Dr. David Shulkin and the White House. The White House claiming that he willingly left leadership of the VA health system. Shulkin vehemently denies that claim, saying that he was fired. The distinction matters. Shulkin could sue over wrongful firing. The Trump administration has been pushing for increased privatization of the VA. But Shulkin was reluctant to enact a radical privatization of a system that treats 9 million American vets, employs 300,000 people, and is a primary training ground for medical students and residents across the country. Kids and depression, it's a real problem. An even bigger problem, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics, is that 2 out of 3 kids with a diagnosable condition are never adequately screened in the healthcare setting. They have revised guidelines for pediatric mental health screenings, noting that at age 12, kids should receive a mandatory screening for any mental health issues as part of their routine care. Suicide is a leading cause of death for teens, and experts feel this would be a great way to prevent tragedies from happening, and also for more teens to get the treatment interventions they are currently missing out on. The opioid overdose crisis is showing no signs of slowing down. In fact, the number of overdoses continues to rise across the country, due largely to the consumption of fentanyl and extremely potent synthetic narcotics that are much cheaper to obtain. Now, the CDC believes the actual numbers of overdoses may be underreported across the country. Many medical examiners not including overdose as a cause for such things as cardiac arrest. Meanwhile, where there's smoke, there may be less fire, it seems. Two U.S. studies have confirmed an interesting trend. In states where marijuana use has been legalized, there's a discernible drop in opioid prescriptions. According to one study, states with medical marijuana laws showed a 6% drop in opioid prescriptions among the Medicaid population. And there was another study that looked at Medicare populations, health care for the nation's seniors, and found that in states with legal marijuana dispensaries, opioid prescriptions went down by 3.7 million doses from the 23 million annual doses among Medicare recipients. While the study did not differentiate between whether the marijuana is being used for medicinal or recreational use, one study author suggests it's starting to be considered as a non-lethal alternative to the highly addictive opioids, which lead to roughly 90 deaths per day. Haifi Wen, the co-author of the Medicaid study and researcher at the University of Kentucky College of Public Health, said that marijuana is one of the potential non-opioid alternatives that can relieve pain at a relatively lower risk of addiction and virtually no risk of overdose. Clients of a Cleveland fertility clinic have filed a class action suit against the University Hospital Medical Center after a liquid nitrogen tank malfunctioned in the clinic's freezer and led to a rise in temperature that went undetected for a weekend, leading to the destruction of thousands of embryos. The clinic's alarm system failed to signal lab technicians that there was a problem, and the frozen embryos were rendered unusable. A number of the specimens that were destroyed were from young people who had gone through chemotherapy treatment, rendering them infertile. The company has apologized and is launching a full investigation into the incident. Meanwhile, overall fertility rates in this country have been on the decline in recent decades. Millennials choosing to delay having children, a trend that's being replicated across many industrialized nations. However, there has been a rise in women 40 to 44 having children as fertility science has improved over time, allowing women to wait till after they've gained their PhDs or elevated their business status before having kids. Over 50% of the unmarried American women have had a child, signaling a shift in the fertility rate. Not only are women having children, they're having more of them. The Pew Research study showed in 2008, mothers had 1.86 children. That number has since jumped to 2.7 children. And the median age of mothers has jumped from 23 to 26 in a decade due to several factors, including a big drop in teen pregnancies. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Kelly Bruno, President and CEO of the National Health Foundation, a Los Angeles-based nonprofit entity dedicated to closing gaps in the healthcare system by creating programs that address the social determinants that lead to poor health. Previously, Ms. Bruno served as Chief Operating Officer and Vice President of Programs at the Foundation, overseeing numerous innovative initiatives. Prior to joining NHF, Ms. Bruno was Vice President of One Generation, which supports intergenerational shared site programming for child and senior daycare participants. Ms. Bruno served several nonprofit organizations such as Tierra del Sol Foundation, Santa Clarita Valley Youth Project, and the Santa Clarita Valley Domestic Violence Center. She earned her BA in social work at Azusa Pacific University, or MSW, at Cal State Long Beach. Kelly, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you for having me.
Our producer saw you at South by Southwest Conference in Austin, Texas, and it was one of the largest gatherings in the world for the intersection of arts and ideas, and healthcare has become a prominent topic at this annual event. And your panel addressed the challenge many of us in healthcare are grappling with, how to make health equity a reality for everyone. And it's a core foundation principle for the National Health Foundation. And I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners what kinds of partnerships are required and how do you make such an impact on these initiatives?
National Health Foundation has recognized, as have many healthcare providers, that healthcare has simply changed over the course of the last few years, that 80% of what makes an individual healthy are those social determinants of health, education, access to healthy food and water, built environments, housing are some examples of those, and that the health disparities that we see in under-resourced communities are because of those social determinants of health. And in order to address this, we need to look at the root causes of the problems of health and address those things then and not after we already see the problem has occurred. I like to tell a story about a woman that lives in South Los Angeles, and we can call her Kate. And she wakes up one morning and recognizes or feels thirsty and knows that that's not typical. And so she takes the bus down to her local hospital, and the doctor tells her that she has prediabetes and that he recommends to her that she eat more fruits and vegetables and does some exercise and to come back if those symptoms persist. And so she leaves the hospital and she goes home, and on her way home, she passes 13 McDonald's, 5 Taco Bells, an In-N-Out Burger, and a Pan Express. And needless to say, in a few weeks, her symptoms have not subsided. And so she goes back to the doctor. He, too, is concerned, and what he does is he suggests and puts her into an education program to teach her how to eat better. Kate is fully aware of what a carrot is, what it looks like, and how good it tastes, but she does not have access to that carrot on that path that I just described that was her way home. So as a society, until we change the path that Kate is walking on or going home on, we cannot possibly expect her to be healthy. And so that is what National Health Foundation does, is we're working to change the path that Kate walks on, and that is what health equity looks like for us, that every community has just as many grocery stores as the other. I'm very fortunate to live in a nice community, and we have grocery stores on every corner. So my ability to be healthy is far greater than her ability ever will be. Now, the partners that are needed for this are tremendous. I mean, hospitals, clinics, businesses, other nonprofit organizations. But what's most important and the most important partner are the residents that live in that community. And oftentimes we feel that that's who's left out, is it's these big policymakers and big important people that make the decisions. And those that live in those communities are often left out of those decisions.
Well, Kelly, the words, she knows what a carrot is, kind of stick in my mind as a, you know, kind of a duh moment. We also focus very much in our work on tackling these upstream issues of social determinants of health as a crucial strategy to improving health outcomes. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about one of the initiatives that you've spearheaded, which dives a level deeper into trying to close these gaps. I know you've been engaged in the Pathway Recuperative Care Initiative, which recognizes that if somebody is in the hospital and then is discharged not to a comfortable, warm, supportive bedroom with people to take care of them, but instead are discharged to the street, that can be very challenging as well. So tell us about how you're supplying bed space for healing and recuperation for homeless patients who are being reduced from the hospital. What are you finding?
Yes, the National Health Foundation has been involved with Pathway Recuperative Care since 2007, and you framed the concern beautifully. Hospitals had homeless individuals or those experiencing homelessness being discharged from their hospital and simply had no safe, appropriate place with which to discharge them. I often say that if you and I were in the hospital, we would go home and eat chicken noodle soup and recuperate for, you know, a week or so before we would return to work. And when you are individual experiencing homelessness and have no home to go to, that simply isn't an option. So those individuals go back to the street, which is the worst possible place to recuperate, and then, of course, end up right back into the emergency room a day later. So Pathway Recuperative Care has utilized local motels to provide that home. So hospitals are able to discharge their individuals experiencing homelessness to us. We accommodate them within hours of their discharge. They come right to us, and we provide that home. We provide medical oversight, a safe, appropriate place with which to recuperate. We help them with their medicines. We don't distribute medicines ourselves, but we help them with that education. And then we connect them, hopefully, on the back end of some sort of housing. We've seen tremendous outcomes. We partner currently with 60 hospitals here in Los Angeles, and we've estimated that we've saved the hospital community or avoided costs of over $35 million since 2010, serving over 4,000 individuals in our programs. And the goals of our program are really quite simple. We are hoping that we can advance every individual's housing plan when they're with us, that they are closer to housing when they leave us than they were when they got there, that they're better able to handle their own health and their own medicines, and that finally that they're better connected to the community. Los Angeles has the largest homeless population, and it really has a concerted effort right now to connect every single provider so that we can collectively work on ending homelessness for as many people as possible. So our program is a piece of that continuum, and we play a role in solving that for many people.
We're speaking today with Kelly Bruno, President and CEO of the National Health Foundation, a nonprofit entity dedicated to developing programs that address the upstream social determinants that lead to poor health. Kelly, let's drill down a little further into the idea of food is health, and access to food remains a real challenge for many Americans, 1 in 7 in the U.S. facing hunger each year, and the rates for children are even more alarming, with about 1 in 5 children lacking proper access to food at some point during the year. And federal government is considering a shift in the SNAP program, which provides food assistance to some 45 million vulnerable Americans. And they're talking about sending blue apron-like boxes of government provisions in place of the current system, which provides financial assistance for SNAP recipients. And your organization has come out strongly against that. And how do we do better?
You know, the SNAP and the SNAP-Ed program provides more than just a meal. You know, there's been research that's been done that shows that every $5 in SNAP funding actually provides $9 in economic development for the communities with which it serves. And so this blue apron type of a solution really takes that out of the equation. And that obviously falls into the social determinants that we spoke about earlier. The cultural sensitivity we feel would be lost with this, you know, somebody else making the choices of the food, or that they just wouldn't be as culturally sensitive. And the education portion is also missing. You know, SNAP here is also accompanied with SNAP Ed, which is the educational piece that goes with the SNAP benefit. So it kind of takes the free market out of the equation, which kind of is against what our administration is really speaking about now. But really, when I look at how we can do better. Our feeling is that we really need to focus a little bit more on making sure that those people or those individuals that are intended to receive the SNAP benefit are actually receiving the benefit. There are huge populations, the elderly population in particular, that are simply eligible for this benefit but are not signing up. And focusing more so on the barriers that exist mm-hmm. as to why these populations aren't signing up for the benefit in the first place is really where we feel we should be focusing our time. And I like to say that we really should be focused on not worrying about the individual that's signed up for SNAP, that mm-hmm. shouldn't be, but more so concerned about that person that isn't signed up that should be.
Hmm. Well, Kelly, you've also gained national attention for yet another program that you've helped develop known as Intergenerational Shared Site Programming, that brings children in daycare centers and seniors in adult daycare facilities together under one roof. And I know you've collaborated with institutions such as Penn State and Virginia Tech, researching the effectiveness of these programs, even in preventing cognitive decline among the seniors, as well as, of course, offering some important early childhood development benefits. Tell us about this work that you began while at One Generation, and is this idea actually gaining momentum across the country?
You know, our society was built on being intergenerational. If you look back multiple, you know, years, you'll see that there were multiple generations in each house that had a grandmother and a mother. And so you didn't have to force that intergenerational interaction. It was already there. And what we found, though, is that there are benefits to that engagement that our children today simply don't have. And so we actually did do research on our intergenerational program when I was at One Generation with Virginia Tech. And what we were able to show is that the children who attended our program for at least 2 years showed higher levels of empathy than children who attended a non-intergenerational program. And what I like to say is it's not necessarily what the children think about the older generations, it's what they don't think. Mm-hmm. It's because they had interactions with what they call the neighbors from birth. And so they don't have those stereotypes that have already been developed. They have their own experiences, and those experiences shape their ideals. and their empathy improves because of it.
Kelly, the upstream movement has gained momentum under the Affordable Care Act, which has expanded coverage to over 20 million Americans. And the expansion of Medicaid has allowed states to become more innovative and responsive to the needs of the underserved population who have suffered the worst effects of the lack of access to decent health. And we're seeing continued efforts to undermine parts of the law, both in Washington and in states around the country, with a number of states now requesting from the administration a work requirement for Medicaid recipients. And I wonder if you could talk about the role of Medicaid expansion and the ACA have played in closing health equity gaps and what policies you're advocating for.
ACA has had a tremendous impact on health equity and ensuring that more people, Medicaid in particular, receive coverage. Before that, if you were between the ages of 25 and 64, there were very few programs that you would be eligible for. That is no longer the case. And you can see that change ripple through the community. And hospitals, I think, are probably one of the most noticeable places, whereas any nonprofit hospital has a community benefit requirement that they have to spend dollars within the community for those less fortunate or for programs that need their help. And before the ACA, the vast majority of those dollars were spent on ensuring or providing care for those that didn't have coverage. Well, now that's not the case. Now they have coverage. So you have nonprofit hospitals that have a tremendous larger amount of money to spend on the community than they've ever had before. And together, you see a lot of hospitals making great strides in ensuring that those dollars are spent on upstream solutions. I think keeping our eye on hospitals right now mm-hmm. is where we should be spending some time, because there is a lot of dollars there, but also a lot of momentum on the part of the hospitals to be a part of that solution.
Hmm. Well, Kelly, I want to maybe just ask you for your thoughts on what you're doing to address one more, which is literacy and specifically health literacy. I know you've had a number of programs developed. Maybe share some of the success from these pilots. And we'd love to give you a chance to just tell us a little bit more about the National Health Foundation. I know it's Los Angeles-based, but what were its origins and where did the support come from? If you'd like to take a moment to educate our listeners about that as well, that would be great.
A lot of our health literacy programs, most of them are community-based. And so we really believe that health is local and that addressing these issues and these barriers at the local level is really the best way to address them. A percentage of our programs, a significant percentage, are in high schools and deal with teenagers. And we allow them to identify the health barriers that exist within their high school community and then come up with their own solutions to addressing them. And some of the outcomes and the things that they've come up with have been pretty remarkable, one of which was that they determined that drinking fountains in their high school were less than stellar. And so they raised the money necessary to put a Brita hydration station in their high school. They redesigned the cafeteria, didn't need any money, but did that so that they could increase the number of students that were able to get through the line in the short amount of time that they had for lunch. I believe they increased it by over 25%. And they also came up with a brilliant strategy called the share table, which allows students that get free breakfast in the morning who may have some non-perishable items, you know, fruits, vegetables, or, you know, things like that, to put those items on a table in each classroom in the morning so that throughout the day, students can grab from that table a healthy snack as opposed to the hot Cheetos, Coke that they're getting at the market. So all student-led, all reducing barriers, and all really improving health outcomes for their community. And it's kind of that perspective that NHF works from, is really involving the community in identifying those solutions. A National Health Foundation, its mission is to improve the health of under-resourced communities by taking action on the social determinants of health. And we have been in existence for almost 50 years. We are a private nonprofit organization, and we are multi-stream funded, but a lot of our funding comes from individual donations, private foundations, minimal amount of government funding as well.
We're speaking today with Kelly Bruno, President and CEO of the National Health Foundation, dedicated to developing programs to address the upstream social determinants that lead to poor health. You can learn more about their work by going to nationalhealthfoundation.org or follow them on Twitter at National Health Foundation. Kelly, thank you so much for your work and for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
The number of people collecting benefits under the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly called food stamps, has been declining since fiscal year 2014. Consistent with that trend, average monthly enrollment decreased by about 2 million from fiscal year 2016 to fiscal year 2017. That happened partly on President Donald Trump's watch. Trump took office on January 20th, 2017, while the 2017 fiscal year started on October 1st, 2016. So about 4 months, a third of that fiscal year, were during Barack Obama's presidency. But some pundits have attributed the entire drop in enrollment last fiscal year to Trump's policies. On Fox and Friends on March 17th, Rachel Campos Duffy said, quote, 2 million Americans are off of food stamps. Claiming this was the opposite of what happened in the Obama administration and that the number was now coming down in 1 year. But the number has been declining for several years. The statement turned into a meme that has been circulating on Facebook, where many of our readers saw it and asked us about it. Let's take a look at the numbers. The number of people enrolled in SNAP initially increased during the Obama administration, a consequence of the deep recession that began in 2007, according to a report by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. Those on food stamps reached a peak average monthly enrollment of 47.6 million in fiscal year 2013. But then SNAP enrollment decreased as the economy recovered and poverty and unemployment rates went down. Enrollment was down to 42.7 million in January 2017 when Obama left office. That decline has continued under Trump. The rate of the decrease, however, is slower. Enrollment went down by 1.35 million from January 2017, when Trump took office, to December 2017, according to the most recent monthly figures from the USDA, which administers SNAP. By comparison, enrollment declined by 1.88 million over the same time period in 2016 when Obama was president. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Childhood obesity has reached epidemic proportions in this country, and it's reaching into the most vulnerable populations, toddlers and preschoolers. The trend was particularly disturbing to Louisiana State University behavioral and community health professor Dr. Melinda Southern, who said the numbers of obese children in Louisiana preschool is particularly distressing.
On average across the United States, 15% of children 0 to 5 years are obese or overweight, and in the minority populations, it's actually one-third, so it's much greater. And in Louisiana, it's actually in that population greater as well. And then as they approach adolescence, their risk for developing type 2 diabetes and high cholesterol and high blood pressure also increases.
Dr. Sutherland discovered that a majority of the children in Head Start programs across the state are spending much more time in sedentary activities, almost 90% of the time. They devised a program that brought dietitians into a series of Head Start daycare centers and created opportunities for the children to increase their movement every day. using accelerometers, they were able to get accurate assessments of increased movement among the children.
That measured how long they were being physically active and how hard or how intense. And about 80% of the time, these 0 to 5-year-olds were sitting or lying. They were not being physically active. What we found was that only in the intervention centers did we see an increase in physical activity. It was a 22% increase in total physical activity. And what was even more amazing was a 50% increase in the vigorous activity that we really want those preschoolers to engage in.
The study was published in the journal Childhood Obesity, a low-cost intervention that has the potential to have significant impact on one of the underlying causes leading to childhood obesity, which is sedentary lifestyle. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.